to an American public profoundly disillusioned with war and U.S. involvement in warlike actions. The approaching final drawdown in Afghanistan is being seen for many as a final exhalation, a collective sigh of relief that it's over. Well, don't get your hopes up. Our guest today believes that conflicts in the future will be on the rise, will be different, and will be more all-inclusive. And I don't want to oversimplify, so let's get into the conversation with David Kilcullen. He is the author of Previously, The Accidental Guerrilla and Counterinsurgency, which was pretty much the Bible of counterinsurgency theory and a playbook for General Petraeus and the surge in Iraq. His latest work is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. David Kilcullen, welcome to the Studios of POTUS.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I am looking at what you have written here, and this is a complex book, but I think what we can get through here is just an understanding of where your mind is. First of all, this book came out of a sit-down at the Bryant Park Hotel, right? I mean, this was one of those on the back of napkins back and forth with a friend of yours.
Mm. I was just back from Iraq, and if anyone knows the Bryant Park Hotel, it's in the Fashion District in Manhattan. It's surrounded by a bunch of skyscrapers. It's actually in a pretty tall building itself. And I was feeling kind of a little freaked out, actually, by being back in this sort of very dense, kind of hipster, dark kind of environment of midtown Manhattan. And I was talking to my friend Steve Eames, who was in the Australian Army with me, and he spent 10 years kicking around various Olympic Games, the Asian Games, a bunch of industrial sites in Africa as an NGO advocate, you know, doing sort of big event security. And he said to me, you know, you guys may have succeeded in Iraq in reducing civilian casualties in Baghdad, but you did it by killing the city. And we had this whole discussion about a city is not just a piece of urban terrain. It's actually a flow system with people moving back and forward. People have to do things. If you make the city secure, but at the price of people can't do the things they need to do, they can't go where they need to go, you're effectively killing the city. So we began to kind of think through, you know, what does the Olympic security community know? What do urban planners know? What do architects know about how cities function, and what have we just learned in a place like Baghdad, and how can we start to think about how they intersect? So that, you know, conversation over whiskey became a fairly detailed discussion that we've been having for several years, and we've been working in a variety of pretty interesting cities on the planet to try to deal with what I think are going to be some of the really critical new challenges of the next generation.
Critical new challenges: population growth, urbanization, littoralization, and connectedness. And I'd like to go through those, because your whole idea is what you call urban metabolism, and it is the city as a system, as you just said. Let's go through those, if we could. Give us a sense of what that's about.
Well, let me just preface this by saying urban metabolism is not my idea. It's something that's been very well understood in the urban planning community for about 30 years or so. What we're doing, though, is putting a little bit of a twist on how people typically understand the metabolism of cities. People think about, if you think about your body and you think about the various inputs that you have, mm-hmm. And the processes that transform those inputs that result in, you know, biomass and energy, a bunch of other things, but they also result in toxins that have to be metabolized and dealt with, otherwise you get sick. The theory that has become very popular in urban planning is the idea that, or urban ecology, I should say, is the idea that cities are like that. There are various intakes that come in, food, water, fuel, air, that have to be transformed in the city, and then they result in waste products that the city has to deal with. What we're doing is looking at the same thing, but through a slightly different lens, not thinking so much about physical metabolism, but money and information and weapons and drugs, things that flow through an urban environment. And if they're not, if the city doesn't have the carrying capacity to deal with what it's experiencing, then you can see a buildup of violence and a buildup of crime and a variety of other things that undermine the functioning of the city. So trying to take a very well understood concept in urban ecology and apply it to the conflict environment and think about how does that apply to what we're trying to do over the future.
The first two issues I mentioned, population growth and urbanization. Clearly the population growth in the world has been spectacular, and it is mostly in the urban areas, right? I mean, this
That's right.
Part of the problem
yeah.
is that you're seeing.
And if we go back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in Europe in 1750, at that time the population of the planet was about 750 million people in total. Between then and 1900, it doubled to 1.5 billion. It doubled again by 1960, and that's despite both world wars and a giant flu pandemic. It doubled again by the year 2000 to 6 billion. And in just a dozen years since then, we've added another billion people to the planet. So it's not only growing, but it's accelerating. The guys that do this for a living in the UN and various other demographic projection agencies believe that we're not going to keep on accelerating forever. We're going to top out at some point in the middle of this century. But we're going to top out at something like 9.2 to 9.5 billion people on the planet. So in the next generation, we're talking about another 3 billion people. And they're
stunning, by the way, the numbers in here you have of the cities. Seoul, the acceleration, and that's a pretty nice city, and other cities which are not nearly so nice. The number of people who have immigrated or made their way to those cities is just stunning.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, it's about 1.4 million people per week, or about 180,000 people per day that move to a city across the planet. And almost all, in fact, all of the 3 billion people that we expect to add to the global population between now and the middle of the century are going to be going into urban environments. And those urban environments are not evenly distributed. They're primarily in the developing world and almost entirely on coastlines. So we're looking at coastal, developing world, very crowded, complex urban environments that just may not have the infrastructure or what we might say the carrying capacity to handle the pace and the scale of growth that they're experiencing. And my thesis is that, you know, that's probably going to have some kind of an effect on conflict.
I would think. Literalization, it sounds like oceanography one, and it also reminds me of bass fishing.
Right.
Because you're always looking for the right zone for where the fish are.
Yeah.
But it has obviously a very different meaning here. It is to that point about the flow, though, right? I mean, this is what it's all about. It's the fact that this is something that is in flux most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a clunky word, right? I mean, it just means coastal urbanization, right? The movement of populations to coastal environments. Very, very prominent feature of the late 20th century. So if we think about the Mediterranean basin, you know, North Africa, the Middle East, and Southern Europe, across that area between 1970 and 2000, nearly 40 million people moved to cities on coastlines. And it's very interesting. If you look at the level of coastal urbanization of countries across North Africa, the three most littoralized of those countries were Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. And, of course, they were the three countries that experienced the most intense uprisings during the Arab Spring of 2011. And as I suggest in the book, that's not an accident. It's because of the high degree of connectivity that's happening in these urban environments. And that's the really new trend. Things like city growth and population growth and people moving to coastlines, that's well understood. It's been around for decades. What's new, though, is connectivity.
The idea that you can have internet almost anywhere. I mean, frankly, I was reading, I didn't realize that Bashar al-Assad was such a computer wingnut when he was young.
Yeah.
He was a geek.
He was a geek, yeah. He was a
computer.
And that makes
a big difference. Even the extent to which, as you discussed in the parts on Libya, the extent to which Muammar Gaddafi was very much tied into the internet. The idea using the internet to try to block. The idea that people who gather in a community can somehow overcome the government's trying to cut down on their rights to protest by working together. I mean, the technical expertise and the skill and the cooperation among those who are protesting, to me, is at a level that we've never seen. And
absolutely,
the capability is just stunning.
No, it's incredible. And there's an enormous growth in not only the internet, but cell phones in particular, and in access to satellite.
More people, by the way, as you point out, have cell phones in the world than have access to clean water or toilets.
That's right. There's about 6 billion cell phones in the world, and only about 4.5 billion people have access to clean water or to a toilet. So, in fact, the UN published some documentation earlier this year suggesting that that's a bit of a scandal, that we haven't really been able to address the physical needs of people, particularly in urban environments. But as far as connectivity goes, it really changes not only conflict, but every other aspect of life in a city. So two conflict examples. When Gaddafi gave up his nuclear ambitions in 2003 and opened Libya up to the outside world, for the first time in the entire history of Libya since independence, people in Benghazi, in the eastern part of Libya, were able to see on satellite television how the rest of the country was, and also how places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, how those places are. Because Cyrenaica, where Benghazi is, the eastern part of Libya, that's where a lot of the oil and gas revenue that drove economic growth under Gaddafi, where that all came from. But that area, he was from the other part of the country. And so he basically didn't provide any funding or any infrastructure or any support to the population in the eastern part of the country. They were living in, you know, a really run-down city with often sewage on the streets and no electricity and not enough water. And suddenly they saw on television what was going on in the rest of the world, and they were like, oh, hang on a second. And a lot of the violence, of course, in Libya began from an uprising in the east, when people just said, "Look, enough! We've seen what you've been doing to us for the last generation, and we don't want to put up with it anymore."
Because of that connectedness
which didn't exist until just a few years ago, right? I mean, there were 30,000 people with cell phones in Libya in 2000. Today, there's, you know, millions of people. So it's dramatic growth in not only cell phones, satellite television, the internet, and so on. In Syria, when Hafez al-Assad, the old president of Syria, had to deal with the Muslim Brotherhood uprising in the 1980s, he just went out and crushed the uprising in Hama with nerve gas and tanks, and killed a vast number of people. But if you talk to journalists who walked around Syria at that time, they will say, if you went to other towns in Syria, people would say, hey, we heard something happened in Hama. What happened? And nobody really knew. So the regime was able to crush these uprisings that happened in little towns one at a time and redeploy its forces as it needed to just fight people in a sort of piecemeal fashion. This time around, everybody knew what was going on in the Arab Spring. Everybody knew what had happened in Egypt and in Tunisia and in Libya. And when the first uprisings began in Deraa and Deir ez-Zor, suddenly everybody across the country began to rise up, and the regime wasn't able to put a lid on it. And I think that's a new phenomenon that, again, wouldn't have existed even a few years ago.
And a template for the future. The book, again, is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. David Kilcullen is the author. I want to mention a couple of cities because early on in the book you talk about Mumbai, which you say exemplifies the higher end of the threat spectrum, the idea of the urban siege. And you also talk about Mogadishu. I want to get to Mogadishu because people are familiar with that in Somalia, but you call it a feral city, and there are several of these. This, it seems to me, is some of the most dangerous because it is really a lot of people, and it's Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, I mean, so the idea of the feral city comes from a Naval War College professor by the name of Richard Norton, who wrote an article in 2003, which basically pointed out that we often tend to assume that when a government collapses, that means cities are going to die. And he says, actually, no, they don't die. They go feral, right? They escape from domesticated control. And you see the emergence of kind of a Mad Max, Lord of the Flies environment where people organize themselves in networks and they get what they need from informal structures that aren't sponsored by the government. Now, when we look at Somalia, the conventional wisdom, I think, has been that first the state collapsed, you know, the Siad Barre regime in 1991 collapsed, and then the city went feral. But if you talk to Somalis, and I spent some time there last year and walked around on the streets talking with people, and have also engaged with a number of Somali authors about this, if you talk to people that were there at the time, they say that what happened was that Mogadishu experienced a generation of rapid urban growth, rapid population movement from rural areas into the city. People who came from different clans in the countryside moved in and replaced the traditional urban population of Mogadishu. Mm-hmm. And that created a whole series of fiefdoms that competed with each other and ultimately tore the state apart and allowed them to run their little fiefdoms after Siad Barre's regime collapsed. So the argument of a lot of these Somalis is Mogadishu didn't become feral because the state collapsed. The state collapsed because the city was already feral, and it went feral because of this dramatic growth in population and urbanization in this coastal city that happened in the generation before the collapse of the regime.
By the way, I love the detail of which, of course, people remember Black Hawk Down in Mogadishu, but the level to which you get in discussing that rescue mission, partly because it got down to such things as why they attacked during daylight when they normally wouldn't do that when they had the advantage at night, even to the point of the caught chewing, which is something that they used to do, and it's an upper, if you will, and it's an and the idea is, well, you wait till the end of the day when they're coming down from the chewing, but they didn't do that. I mean, that is one of the little parts of the battle that
is just caught is an interesting thing. It's a fascinating thing. You know, when you drive around Somalia or you walk around the streets, you see these little bunches of greenery on stalls on the side of the road. They look like sort of bunches of herbs. And that's the hut. And it gets distributed through a really complex, sophisticated system that goes across the whole Horn of Africa and Yemen and Djibouti and a bunch of areas in that part of Africa. And it's just the way that they distribute the cut shows you how sophisticated these non-state systems can be in moving things around. It's not illegal. It's not a drug in a narcotic sense, but it's a pretty strong stimulant.
And people, it's like 10 cups of coffee.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's like jolt, right? People get kind of hopped up on it. And it's interesting. It's very bitter. If you chew it, it tastes like what it is, which is a weed.
That's why the only Coca-Cola plant in the country is still there, you write in here.
Yeah, and what's one of the things that I think is quite fascinating is, you know, one of the very few industrial facilities to survive this collapse of the regime, the civil war, the arrival of the UN, all this fighting over the last 20 years, still functioning today is the Coca-Cola bottling plant outside of Mogadishu. Because everybody agrees you got to have something to drink with your cut. Now, people chew it, takes all day for them to get high on it, and then they all crash and sleep it off in the afternoon. In the evening, actually. One of the worst times of the day to attack a nest of cut-shooting militiamen is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Sure.
Which is when
at their peak.
We did it, yeah. But I think it's important to understand the Americans in Mogadishu were working on a different unit of analysis, if you like. They were doing what we call time-sensitive targeting in the business. And what they were doing was finding a particular individual and targeting that guy in order to target a network. So they had to move in because that's when the target was available. They didn't think about the city as an organism or the city as a flow model. They thought about the individual network that they were trying to target, and they came up with a certain answer. Now, the terrorists who attacked Mumbai in 2008 did it in a completely different way.
Amazingly disciplined, by the way.
Very
much so.
The
way you detail it, very connected to one another, and understood exactly what they were doing.
Right.
It's Lashkar-e-Taiba, right?
Lashkar-e-Taiba, yeah, sponsored by folks in Pakistan. And they were not targeting individuals so much as targeting the city itself. So the first few targets that these guys attacked were a major cafe, which is a tourist center, a hospital, and the most important railway station of the city. And they attacked it at rush hour on the main commuter platform, and the largest single loss of life in the entire attack happened at the terminus railway station. They did that in order to disrupt the city, to call off the Indian first responders and make the city shut down and make it more easy for them to then attack their major targets, which were two luxury hotels and a Jewish community center.
You introduced something important here, I think, and that is the idea of democratization of technology. You call it the non-state armed groups fielding highly lethal capabilities that were once the sole preserve of nation states. So they've got the bombs, they've got the communications capabilities, all the things that in some ways lead to that sort of symmetric approach or asymmetric approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think the attack of Lashkar-e-Taiba against Mumbai was frighteningly professional. They left Karachi in Pakistan in a small coastal freighter. They infiltrated the coastal fishing fleet. In the middle of the night, they hijacked an Indian fishing boat, killed the crew, got the captain to sail them to just offshore of Mumbai, and then they cross-decked in the middle of the night to little rubber boats in a swell of 1 or 2 meters. So a pretty difficult technical feat. They then navigated ashore, landed in a slum area that was right next to the targets. They were detected as they landed, but most people that saw them thought that they were smugglers or illegal immigrants, so they just left them alone. And then
those are the usual criminals who are around here.
Right. There's some evidence that the captain of the fishing trawler that they hijacked let them on board because he thought they were smugglers. He had a couple of smuggling convictions himself. And so there was a kind of belief that they infiltrated not only the physical network, you know, the fishing fleet in the middle of the night, but they infiltrated an illicit network that connects Karachi with Mumbai anyway. People allowed them into the system, and sort of like a parasite in the bloodstream, they were able to find their way where they needed to go within the city. Now, it wasn't accidental. They spent more than a year studying exactly how the city functioned.
Again, to your sense, frighteningly
effective. Frighteningly professional. And, you know, I've talked to Navy SEAL officers and others who have a lot of experience in coastal special operations, and they'll say any special operations force in the world would be proud to be able to pull off an attack that was that sophisticated, obviously without necessarily the civilian loss of life that the terrorists inflicted also.
Once again, we are talking about with David Kilcullen about his book, Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. In here you write, for those who are just joining the conversation, in general terms, the environment for future conflict clearly shifting the four megatrends of population growth, urbanization, littoralization, and the connectedness suggest the conflict is increasingly likely to occur in coastal cities, in highly networked, connected settings, Adversaries are likely to be non-state armed groups, whether criminal or military, or to adapt asymmetric methods. Even the most conventional hypothetical war scenarios turn out, when closely examined, to involve very significant irregular aspects. You also write later that war as we know it, or conflict as we know it, is changing. It's not going to be Afghanistan. You go through some of these cities, like we just mentioned, with Mogadishu and Mumbai and some of the attacks down there. You also even feature for a brief moment the worst living cities in the world, and and so on. What strikes me about this as I'm looking at it, though, is that you wonder how it works in conjunction with some of your previous work. For example, when you talk about the idea of getting in the hearts and minds and knowledge, because clearly, if you are to be able to succeed against this kind of an obstacle, you have to have a knowledge of the situation. But that almost requires being embedded in every single one of these situations. And the connectedness can work in some ways to your advantage, I would guess. But it also is a disadvantage, because if you're spotted immediately, you're gone and you're out. You've got no time to. So talk about that challenge a little bit.
So let me talk about the transitional aspect first. I mean, although I do argue, as you say, that the future of conflict is not going to be more Afghanistan's. You know, it's not going to be landlocked, mountainous,
or
underpopulated
or
areas.
Saving Private Ryan hitting the beach in Omaha.
Yeah, so the data is pretty clear on this, that conventional war between nation states is actually getting rarer. It's been getting rarer for about 50 years, and it's continuing to get more uncommon. The level of fighting between irregular actors, that is non-state armed groups, stays about level. And what that means is that over time, a greater and greater proportion of conflict is irregular conflict, conflict involving non-state actors. That doesn't mean conflicts won't still happen in deserts like Mali or in mountains. That will happen. But as a proportion of the whole, because conflict tends to happen where people live, we need to get more comfortable with the idea of these very crowded urban environments, what the urban theorist Mike Davis calls a planet of slums, right? These mega city slums that are now covering pretty substantial areas of the coastline. Now, I should be clear, in the book I say I don't think there are any military solutions to this problem. I don't think that there's a magic formula for how militaries should engage in these circumstances in order to fix these problems. I mean, a mega city the size of, one of the major South Asian cities or an African city or a Latin American city could absorb a brigade or a division of troops without even noticing. You know, I mean, these are giant urban environments. But the sad fact of life, as I also mentioned in the book, is that even though that might be true, the military is continually called on to do this. And if you look, there's a very, very clear pattern in American military history that goes back to the middle of the 19th century. If you start the clock running around the time of the Mexican War in 1846, between then and now, the U.S. military is engaged in a large-scale or long-duration counterinsurgency or stabilization mission about once every 25 years. Very irregular pattern. And it's engaged in smaller interventions on about the scale of East Timor or Kosovo or Bosnia about once every 5 to 10 years in that time frame. And interestingly, that pattern is completely independent of presidential preferences. So there's been a number of presidents who've come out and said, this is bad, we don't want to keep doing this, we're going to get out of the business of intervening in other people's messy problems. It doesn't seem to make any difference to how often these things happen.
Well, and it brings it, in one part you talk about the theater of war and the changing concept of that. The theater construct helps define spaces of normality, part of a global normative system, international law that divides physical space into a realm of war where the laws and customs of war apply, and a realm of peace where norms of civil society, domestic law, and civil protections apply. But you also discuss this in the context of things like drones. If you are, for example, running a drone in Washington, D.C., that's hitting someplace in Afghanistan, are you not still in a theater of war?
Right.
Because you are part of the process, and process is a big part of this.
Right.
You are part of the process that is underway in that country.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I think one of the ways that people have sought to deal with this complexity that we don't want to engage in is by what I call remote warfare. So things like cyber operations and particularly drones. And drones are actually fully autonomous robotic planes. And here what we're really talking about is remotely piloted aircraft,
right.
RPAs, right? So in the case of the United States, we have guys in Nevada, in upstate New York, in a bunch of different places around the country who are, you know, getting up, having their cup of coffee, having breakfast at home, driving into work, jumping in a room, and then running a remotely piloted aircraft over Afghanistan or over Yemen or some other place on the planet, killing people, and then going to their kids' baseball game in the afternoon before dinner. It's a very, very different set of circumstances than traditionally what we consider to be the theater of war, right, which is the area where combat action takes place. And, of course, the flip side of that is if you're targeting people in that environment, then it's about as legitimate for them to come back at you and try to target the drone pilots and the communities they live in,
sure,
as it was for us to bomb German factories in World War II.
Or to shoot the artillery behind the lines.
Exactly. I mean,
it's the same thing.
And we've already actually seen that. I mean, we saw the Pakistani Taliban mount an attack on New York City in 2010 in retaliation for drone strikes in Pakistan. So this is something that's coming, and it's going to spread. I also think it's worth pointing out that this idea of drones as kind of a magic bullet to solve the problem looks pretty good when we're the only people on the planet with a lot of drones.
Mm-hmm.
There are 70 countries now that have drone programs, and about a third of those have weaponized programs. And there are groups like Hezbollah and like Iran who have drone systems that are out there. The Chinese have armed drones that are operating. So it looks pretty good when we're deciding who gets struck. It's going to look a little different when this has become part of the new normal of what people can field. There's another element of remote warfare that I think is worth pointing out too, which is that the way that the internet has shifted in the last decade, particularly in the last 2 years, is really opening up some incredibly interesting and dangerous new avenues for kinetic cyber operations. So for 20 years or so, people have thought about cyber warfare as primarily hacking your information, you know, defacing your website, doing a denial of service attack so you can't service your customers or whatever that might be. In the last 2 years, we've started to move to what some people call the Internet of Things, where instead of just people having IP addresses, actual things like your fridge and your toaster and your oven and your car have Internet addresses. And that creates all kinds of scope for fairly lethal hacker activity that can be directed by states. You know, one example would be if you have a gas stove in your apartment and your stove is on the Internet and so is your toaster, and you go to work or even when you're asleep at night, I can hack into your system, turn the gas on, wait till your apartment fills up with gas, and then fire up your toaster and blow you up. Right? Oh. That wasn't even feasible 2-3 years ago, but it's becoming more and more the norm. When we look at the way that different states have used hackers in the operations they've conducted in the last few years, starting with the Russians and the attack on Georgia in 2008, looking at how the Syrians and the Libyans and the Egyptians have done it, this is a new element of threat that I think people have yet to fully get their heads around.
I wanted to get to connectivity, by the way. There's a great story in here you have with the BART, which is in San Francisco. I think people can understand the sort of contemporary use of that, where people were protesting and basically the local authority shut down the Internet capability. Mm-hmm. This is in San Francisco.
Yeah.
People got so upset, it turned back around. But I think that gives people an understanding of connectivity. But I don't want to run out of time, and I want to get to something. You have this great quote from Marshall McLuhan from 1970. World War III is a guerrilla information war with no division between military and civilian participation. Part of the reason I bring that up is because you have the use of rabid soccer fans as a part of this uprising. Explain how that whole process.
Well, this is fascinating, and the world authority on this is a guy called James Dorsey, who lives in Singapore, and he's spent 20 years looking at soccer fans across the Middle East and a variety of other places. And if you look at the wars in the Balkans in the 1990s, one of the things that we saw emerging was, I would say, soccer hooligans, violent, militant soccer fans. Guys associated with Red Star Belgrade Soccer Club, for example, were some of the shock troops of the militia that did a lot of the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia and other places. When we look at the Middle East, we see groups called ultras, who are the most militant wing of the soccer clubs in these countries. And they're not just in the Middle East and North Africa, but in those places they've become particularly politicized. And ultras played a key role as shock troops in the uprising in Tunisia, and then again in Egypt, less so in Libya. But they became, these are guys who fight the cops in the normal course of events every Saturday anyway, because they get engaged in violence at the soccer match. So when the uprising came, they weren't frightened of the police. They were used to fighting them anyway. They knew their tactics, and they were able to organize. But the interesting thing, which Jonathan Pollock, who's a writer who has done a lot of work on this, he wrote about this in the MIT Technology Review a couple of years ago. The interesting thing in the case of Tunisia and others was that we had online organizers in democracy activist groups getting the ultras to start working together and coordinating the activity. I talk about the ultras in the uprising as a sort of the ground war, and what was going on the internet and satellite television and radio as the air war. And it's a whole new model of urban irregular uprising.
You have this quote from Pollack in the book: internet and cell phone access was cut or unreliable for the duration. People used whatever limited connections they could. In Benghazi, a citizen journalist named Mohammed Mo Nabas realized he had the knowledge and the equipment from an ISP business he had owned to lash together a satellite internet uplink. With supporters shielding his body from potential snipers, Nabas set up dishes and 9 live webcams for his online TV channel, Libya Al Hura, Libya the Free, running 24/7 on live stream.
Yeah. Mo was tragically killed by a regime sniper a couple of weeks after that. But Jonathan's work is really worth reading on this. He's written extensively on this stuff, and people can get it online. But it's fascinating to see how people were able to cobble together the systems they needed, because it's an urban population that's technically savvy and is able to apply a lot of tools that it uses from its sort of consumer electronics world to conflict. We see people with Android phones using them to direct mortars and rockets, for example, in Syria and in the conflict in Libya. When the regime shut down the internet, they turned a marginalized, fairly minority protest against the regime into a mass uprising, because everybody suddenly had a grievance that they shared. People didn't want to have their connectivity cut off.
Once again, we're talking about Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. David Kilcullen is the author. I asked the question about the participation, because war, I mean, I shoot you, you shoot me, we kill each other or whatever. This is a little bit more complex. We're talking about different kinds of players, not exactly a soldier. And I wonder if the warrior is somewhat obsolete in this. As you quote in here, troops will have to become hikers again, not campers, because it needs to be a lot more flexible. There has to be a lot more resiliency, I guess, is the word, as opposed to stability. So, yeah. So give us a sense of what, I mean, is this the world at war, if you will? Is it faction against faction?
No, I don't think it's all bad, and I don't think it is exactly a negative view of the future. But I think what we have to do is take into account what happens to a city when it experiences this rapid kind of growth that we're talking about. And what you get is kind of a donut-shaped piece of terrain around the outside of the city, which used to be where they grew their food and where the water came from, and it used to be countryside, which now is filled in with, in many cases, slums and informal settlements. And non-state armed groups, you know, in some cases not military but criminal organizations, emerge, and they take charge of the population because there's not a lot of government presence there. We've seen this in places like Nairobi in Kenya, with a gang called Mungiki that dominates the outer areas and basically has a chokehold on transportation systems going in and out of Nairobi. So then politicians in the center of the city don't have a lot of choices. You know, there's guys that are basically able to strangle the city who are sitting out there on the periphery, and they're not, they may look marginal in spatial terms, but they're not at all marginal because they're key players. And so you see governments basically being forced to make deals with these guys. One of what I think is the most interesting case studies in the book is Jamaica, where you see
in Kingston,
where you see a political party basically making a deal with a series of local gangs in what they call garrison neighborhoods in Jamaica, which resulted in kind of a symbiotic relationship between a political party and a gang, which we see as a drug gang because it smuggles drugs into the United States. But that's just one of the things that it does. It's really a social welfare organization and a law and order policing group and a public safety organization. It's a jobs network. It does all sorts of different things because society needs those things, and the government isn't there because the city's grown so quickly that it doesn't have the carrying capacity to deal with it.
I think one of the points you make here, too, when you're talking about the cooperation between different groups, is the paradox is that although there are no purely military solutions, there are also no solutions without the ultimate sanction of coercion to enforce the order that makes joint action possible. So somebody's got to have the guns.
Someone does have the guns in every circumstance, and if it's not you, it's going to be very difficult to get anything done. So to be clear, I'm not suggesting that we go in and invade these places, but if you do want to go in and work in that environment, you have to take account of the fact that someone's in charge. We look at these places, and it used to be fashionable 10 years ago to talk about ungoverned spaces. You know, it's kind of a Here Be Dragons model of the world, right, where there's these ungoverned spaces where, you know, but actually these places are not ungoverned, right? They're not governed by the government, but they're very thoroughly governed, but just by non-state actors. So I think what I push for at the end of the book is this idea that I talk about as co-design. The idea that you've got to be working.
Crisis mappers.
Crisis mappers, sure. Ceasefire Chicago, the Women's Network to End the War in Liberia. The idea that outsiders who have technical knowledge need to collaborate and cooperate with locals who have to be in the lead, who understand the environment, but don't necessarily have access to that technical understanding or a good feel for best practices across the world about how to deal with their particular kind of problem. But that has to happen in a secure environment. Somebody's got to be securing that. Much better that it's the local community or the local police than that it be the military. And of course, much better that it's the local military than we go in there and do it. But someone's got to be creating that safe environment, or people don't feel safe enough to address their problems.
So counterinsurgency, just to sort of wrap this up here, counterinsurgency was around for a long time. You wrote the book on it. I mean, the book,
one of the books.
But it was probably one of the more famous ones. And again, it was one that General Petraeus used a lot of. But it took a long time for a lot of military establishments to embrace the idea. Time to time, they would. And I wonder, when you present this kind of a theory, is this something that also has to go through that labyrinthine, that process, of that bureaucratic process of being vetted and discussed and torn apart and so on? Because clearly this is a shifting paradigm when it comes to dealing with conflicts around the world. It incorporates the U.S., but not just the U.S. There's a sort of a global, not authority, but you have to have a global awareness of this kind of a development. And I wonder how we're going to train the soldiers of tomorrow, the, if not warriors, at least those who will fight this. And it's, again, not a world at war all the time, but still, this is going to be how we're going to have to prepare for it. So the West Points of the world, the naval academies and the Pentagons, are they going to be moving in this direction?
Well, I would say I think that they are moving in this direction. And actually, a lot of what I write about here is well understood in the 1990s by these establishments. And, you know, ideas like the urban littoral were very commonly talked about in the middle of the 1990s. General Victor Krulak, who's a Marine general, was the originator of the idea of the three-block war and the strategic corporal.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Scales, Ralph Peters, you know, the guys that were working on this in the 1990s understood it well. But what's happened is that after 9/11, we found ourselves dragged into a series of conflicts that have absorbed, you know, 110% of our attention. And those conflicts aren't these kinds of conflicts, right? Mm-hmm. We've been in the mountains, we've been in the countryside, even in Iraq, right? Only the U.S. engaged in very significant urban fighting in Iraq, and that was inland. It wasn't anywhere near the ocean. It was in Baghdad City. The only people that really did urban coastal were the British in Basra, and, of course, the Iraqis. But we just, as a group of 50 nations or so that engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq, the vast majority of countries involved had their experience in rural environments, in local valleys and so on. And so a lot of what we understood in the late 1990s, we've not exactly forgotten it, but we've been focused on other stuff in the last decade. And in that time, two things have happened. One, the debate has really moved on, and people in the urban space, urban planners, people that understand urban social conflict have really moved their thinking on, and there's a lot of new research and new data and new available data because of connectivity that's out there. And then the other factor is what we talked about earlier, that when guys like Scales and Krulak and Peters were writing in the 1990s, that was the pre-cell phone era, it was the pre-internet era, pre-satellite radio era, right, for most of these places in the world. Today, it's not. You know, I walked around the streets of Mogadishu last year. There are four major cell phone companies just in Mogadishu. This is a country that hasn't had a government for 20 years. But everyone's got a cell phone. 24% of Somalis have a cell phone. That didn't exist 5, 10 years ago. When Black Hawk Down happened in 1993, nobody had cell phones. So now there's this enormous connectivity that really, I think, changes a little bit the environment in which we operate.
And I will say, too, that, you know, coming at the filter from somebody who grew up in an analog era, as I did, I also have to sometimes remind myself that people who are growing up now grew up with this kind of connectivity, and they're very familiar with it, are comfortable with it, and understand that there are ways to either exploit or protect, depending on your approach to it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think for some people, the clock kind of stopped on 9/11. If you know, we've just passed the anniversary of those horrific attacks. A lot of people sort of think about it as if it was just yesterday, because it was such an important impact. But, you know, there are troops, I met some of them at the end of last year, there are troops walking around Afghanistan, American troops, who were 6 years old on 9/11. 44% of the Afghan population is 15 years old or younger. They were toddlers on 9/11. The world's moved on, and things have changed very significantly in the last dozen years. So I think, as I suggest in the title of the book, which is actually a quote from Osama bin Laden, we have to get our heads out of the mountains. We know that more wars are coming. We know they're not going to look like what we've been doing for the last decade. we've got to re-engage with this whole complex set of problems. I believe that Al-Qaeda will still be out there, terrorists will still be out there, all these problems that we've been dealing with for the last decade will still be around. But if your city's half underwater and gangs are running the transportation system and no one has enough to eat and no one has electricity and the government's not protecting you, the fact that there's a half a dozen terrorists running around, yeah, that's unpleasant, but it's not your major problem, right? Your problem is your city's, you know, not functioning. I think that's where a lot of the planet is going to find itself in the next generation, unless we get ahead of the curve, unless we understand this set of issues and start thinking about it more clearly.
That is a great way to wrap it up. The book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla, David Kilcullen. It has been our pleasure. Thanks for spending time with us in Boston.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here again.
Email.